Good evening. Thank you, whoever said that. Tonight, the topic or the title is The Importance of Paradigm Shifts in Christian Apologetics and Conversion. And that's a bit cumbersome. I'm sorry about that. I didn't at all know what to do back when we made up the list. So I knew I wanted to do this lecture, and I didn't know how to title it. So hopefully I'll tie all that together for you this evening, and you'll understand how I came up with that. Really, what I want to do tonight is I want to provide a new way of looking at the task of apologetics. And I'm hoping that I can sort of introduce a new term into the lexicon of apologetics, that term being paradigm. So I'll be working primarily from a book, at least in the first part of the lecture, and I'll put an overhead up there in a minute, from a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by a guy named Thomas Kuhn. And this is, it even says here on the back cover, this is one of those books that is a landmark in intellectual history, and I'd highly recommend it to anyone. I first read it several years ago as an undergraduate, and it spurred my thinking in a wide range of areas, and I've since reread it a couple times, and it will form sort of the background and of what I'm going to say tonight, and I hope to sort of springboard from it. Kuhn is, I think he may be at MIT, at least he was for a while, and he's a philosopher of science. And as the title implies, he's doing a sort of history and philosophy of science there. So I'm going to try and use his remarks tonight. My own background is not in science, it's in philosophy. So I in no way don't want to present myself as knowing everything about Newtonian physics and Copernican revolutions and all of that. I'll refer to some of that. And we can talk about some of it in the discussion, but my own knowledge is somewhat limited. My background is in philosophy, though, which is what originally attracted me to Kuhn. Tonight, I'm going to be theoretical. In fact, pretty much through and through, I'm going to be theoretical. And I think I'll do another lecture, maybe next term, where we'll get a little more practical. I've got some things that I had to cut off on the end because this is just so long already. So it'll be pretty much theory, and I'll try and keep you apprised of where I am on an outline here so that it doesn't get too jumbled for you. So let's start in. First, apologetics. Apologetics literally means giving a word back. It doesn't mean saying you're sorry for being a Christian. It just the literal definition is giving a word back. It means responding to unbelief, to non-Christians, in a sense defending the faith, offering reasons why we should believe. And I'm assuming tonight that apologetics is biblical and completely necessary. I think the New Testament is filled with examples of the apostles doing apologetics. Some will debate that, and I'm not even going to get into that debate tonight. I'm going to start right in assuming you're with me at that level. Let me show you my outline here. I first want to sort of lay out what a paradigm is, and talk a bit about how Kuhn describes paradigms and paradigm shifts in science. Then I want to show the relevance of that discussion for apologetics, for contemporary apologetics, and then hopefully get into some biblical examples. So first, paradigms and defining the term. A paradigm is a model. It's a framework for approaching a problem. That's the everyday usage. That's if you hear people on the street using the term paradigm, that's what they mean. Kuhn uses it to mean some other things, and I wanted to talk about that a bit. He can be somewhat fluid and difficult to pin down in terms of what he means, and he was aware of this problem. The edition I have of his book is a second edition, and he writes in the postscript, "Turn now to paradigms and ask what they can possibly be. My original text leaves no more obscure or important question. One sympathetic reader who shares my conviction that paradigm names the central philosophical elements of the book prepared a partial analytic index and concluded that the term is used in at least 22 different ways." So, in terms of fluidity, Kuhn does have some problems there. Let's talk about his concept of a paradigm. He says that a paradigm is what members of a scientific community share. It's what they hold in common. Now, this is similar to a theory, but it's a bit broader in scope. A paradigm would be made up of theories. A theory is a guiding principle that reveals the proper interpretation of a group of facts. A paradigm does this, but it does a bit more. It encompasses theories. Paradigm is also similar to the term worldview, and sometimes used interchangeably, although as Kuhn uses it, it's a bit narrower in scope. So his definition, and this is the technical definition, is that it's a disciplinary matrix. Disciplinary referring to a community of practitioners in a special field, a group of people, a discipline. And matrix referring to the ordered elements that make up the field. So the data within the field that they're working with put into a structure of some sort. He also calls it a theoretical construct for explaining a collection of data. He also calls a paradigm that. And he does so because it not only forms the way scientists see a problem, but it also informs the possible solutions they consider. So what a paradigm implies, what a model, is that it's one model and that there could be another way of seeing the problem, could be framed in a different way. Kuhn writes, philosophers of science have repeatedly demonstrated that more than one theoretical construction can always be placed upon a given collection of data. History of science indicates that particularly in the early developmental stages of a new paradigm, it is not even very difficult to invent such alternatives. So thus, a paradigm is a particular model for approaching a problem that offers a conceptual framework for understanding the problem, puts the problem in perspective. Furthermore, it gives researchers direction in solving the smaller puzzles raised by the problem. Now, in law, a paradigm might be synonymous with the term precedent. And Kuhn says, like an accepted judicial decision in the common law, it is an object for further articulation and specification under new or more stringent conditions. So just as judges refer to a paradigm as as a precedent, as a guiding principle in their decisions, and they look to it in terms of how to make new decisions, a paradigm performs the same function within science. Now, I think the best way to understand a paradigm is what I'm calling the theory worldview continuum. And this is not, you won't find this in Kuhn. This is my own little construction here, but I find it helpful. I think it works okay. Picture a continuum with theory on one end, paradigm in the middle, and worldview on the other. And it's a continuum, so it's somewhat flexible. Theory would be the most basic element, the most basic building block. So a theory, for example, might be the equation F equals ma, which is one of Newton's laws or Newton's equation. That would be just a very small piece, a very small building block. You would move from theories to paradigms. You'd put a bunch of theories together and you come to a paradigm. And again, a paradigm being a model that gives meaning to several theories, and it provides a guide for research and experimentation to a whole community of scientists. Then you would have, so you'd have paradigms, and then you'd have worldviews, and paradigms would be the building blocks of worldviews, just as theories were the building blocks of paradigms. I like this because it sort of accounts for the multiple meanings or sort of nuances of the term, and it shows the sort of fluidity that you can get, in terms of between the terms, theory, paradigm, and worldview, but it maintains the distinctness as well, I think. Let me get that. Now, let me throw out a few examples of paradigms, just to sort of nail this down, and I'll just use scientific examples here. I've got four of them that I hope will sort of bring out the nuances, the meanings of the term, as well as sort of show this idea that there's an evolution from theories to paradigms to worldviews. The first example would be the paradigm of evolution. Now, usually we use the word theory, evolutionary theory, or the theory of evolution, but I think paradigm is better. Paradigm includes the guiding role that evolution has taken on. So for disciplines such as paleontology or biology or anthropology, evolution serves as a guiding model. It's really the model for how they go about their research, how they go about working in their fields. The problem that evolution resolves is how to account for the origin and promulgation of the species. And that's what the problem was that Darwin faced and others. And he came up with a model for explaining this problem with purely naturalistic causes. So evolution, in that sense, serves as a paradigm. Now, it can also be referred to as a worldview. And that is when it's referring to the umbrella structure that it takes, or the umbrella status that it has over science as a whole. In other words, through and through all of science these days is evolutionary. So we might talk about evolution in terms of worldview. But when it's working just as a disciplinary matrix for a specific field, then that's evolution as a paradigm. And so that would be one way. A second example would be Lamarck's genetics. You may remember Lamarck. He was the French biologist who argued that offspring inherit the acquired characteristics of their parents. So that, for example, giraffes' necks got longer because the parents stretched to reach the leaves at the highest branches, and they passed on that stretched neck to their offspring. The problem that he was seeking to solve was similar to Darwin's, the diversity and development or evolution of species, as shown in the fossil record. And as I said, he argued that it was through the inheriting of acquired characteristics. Now, due to competition between other paradigms and eventual falsification, this model did not last. But you can see the role that it played in terms of a model explaining a specific problem. It served as an explanatory model for a while. Now, these last two, I think, are interesting because let me just talk about them. The third one I want to throw out is Ptolemaic astronomy. If you remember, Ptolemy was the guy who argued that the universe was geocentric, and that the Earth was the center of the universe, and that the sun and all the planets and all the stars orbited the Earth. And the problem he was really trying to explain was the movement of the celestial bodies, the movement of the planets and things. And this system was developed during the last 2 centuries BC. And as I said, he posited a geocentric universe. Now, it worked admirably well to explain and predict the changing positions of the stars, the planets, and things. And Kuhn comments about it that no other ancient system had performed so well. But to be admirably successful is never to be completely successful. With respect both to planetary motion, planetary position, and precession of the equinoxes, predictions made with Ptolemy's system never quite conform with the best available observations. So it functioned well enough for over 1,000 years to be the model, to be the paradigm under which astronomers looked at the heavens. But eventually the discrepancies became so large that we got to the Copernican Revolution, and we got a new model. A new model came in. However, as a model, Kuhn makes this comment, which I think is interesting, that for the stars, Ptolemaic astronomy is still widely used today as an engineering approximation. So it shows the role as a model or an explanation for celestial motion, and it still works in a limited sense. So it was a model that in one sense has been falsified, and I think this is what I think is interesting about it, but in another sense still works. Let's look at one more example that's similar. And that's the paradigm of Newtonian physics, or Newtonian mechanics. Now, the problem here was explaining the various forces at work in regard to the movement of objects in the universe, the movement of bodies, everything from why things fell to Earth and why the planets orbited the way they did. Newton set forth his equations, or his mechanics, in his book, The Principia. And these equations hold a vast explanatory power, and as I hope everybody knows, if you take high school physics, what you learn is Newton. You learn Newton's laws. And the one I mentioned earlier, F equals MA, is probably one of the first ones you learn. And they still work, and we still use them. However, there are limits to Newton's laws, and as Einstein showed, in terms of very large objects, such as planets, and very small objects, such as atoms, Newton doesn't work. He can't be used. It doesn't. His figures do not equate with the observations. So again, this is one of those things where it's still in use today, Newton's model, Newton's paradigm, by engineers and even some physicists in certain applications. But overall, physicists refer to the Einstein Einsteinian model or paradigm. So let me try and summarize here this first section. A paradigm is a model for resolving a particular problem. It provides a framework for understanding the problem. It is a theoretical construct that could be replaced if a new and better paradigm appeared. It is also open-ended enough to allow for further articulation following research and experimentation. It is composed often of several connected theories, and itself is a building block in a worldview. So that's what paradigms are. That's how I'll be using the term tonight. And that's how Kuhn uses the term throughout his book. Let's move into, and this is sort of going to be the body of the thing tonight, and hopefully I won't go too long, the second section here, making paradigm shifts in science. And what I want to do is really lay out what Kuhn has said, and I'll necessarily be summarizing a lot of what he said, but I do hope to do justice to it. And I'll be quoting him quite often, so you'll know that I'm not diverging too far from his text. And this is likewise the body of his book, if you were to read it. So, making paradigm shifts in science. First, let's talk about what scientists want us to believe. That's the science as accumulation myth there. And this will just be very brief, but this is what the scientists would want us to believe. First, that scientists working under a particular paradigm encounter anomalies. And an anomaly is a piece that doesn't fit the paradigm. It's a paradigm violator. Kuhn says it's a phenomenon for which his paradigm had not readied the investigator. It's a piece of evidence that questions or calls into question the paradigm. It stands in contrast to the predictions of the paradigm. So it's a word I'll be using a lot tonight, anomalies. And it's just a piece that doesn't fit. Anomalies appear only against the background provided by the paradigm, says Kuhn. So you have to have some model, some way of going about the problem and certain solutions you're looking for to realize that you found something that doesn't fit. Now, that's the first stage, is that scientists encounter anomalies. The second stage would be that the anomalies are explored. The research now focuses on the anomaly and seeks to resolve it. The researchers in this case are still under one paradigm and they begin exploring the anomalies in alternative paradigms. The third sort of step or stage would be then that a new paradigm emerges under which the previous anomalies are now explained and fit as accepted facts. So eventually the discrepancy is cleared away, the anomaly is cleared up. Novelties of fact, or these anomalies, lead to novelties of theory or invention of new theory and new paradigms. The idea would be that science has taken one more step forward in the ever-expanding circle of what we know, or that scientific knowledge advances pushing out ignorance. So this is the cumulative or linear view of science. This image of science is what's promoted in scientific textbooks and probably what most all of us learned in grade school, high school, in terms of how science advances. Very linear, very organized, orderly process that over the years and throughout history has marched onward, and we have learned more and more about the world around us and on and on. Kuhn argues that, and in this case, what Kuhn calls revolutions are nearly invisible. There are none of these major paradigm shifts that we're going to talk about in a bit. Nothing like that happens. It's just a linear advance. Sort of as if science is just every once in a while redefining its terms or recalibrating its tools, but nothing that major is going on. Well, Kuhn argues that, as I've stated here, is a myth, that doesn't happen. And although that may be the layman's understanding of science, that's not at all what happens. What happens is a lot messier and a lot less organized and orderly. And I'm going to try and put it into some sense of organization here. But if you read Kuhn, I think he does the history of science justice. In other words, he presents it as messily as it is and as convoluted as it can be. But let's talk about what really happens. And that's part B there, paradigm shifts in reality. First, there's the emergence of a crisis. A crisis is necessary for a change in paradigm. And a crisis is basically a breakdown of the normal puzzle-solving activity. Now, by that, I mean that scientists, when they're working under a specific paradigm, under a specific model, they have puzzles they're working out. The paradigm provides for them additional problems that their research goes into and that their experimentation goes into. And the crisis, as Kuhn says, is when there's a breakdown in this normal puzzle-solving activity. The breakdown begins when the puzzles generated by a paradigm don't come out as they should. Increasingly, the observations do not confirm the theory. Too many facts no longer fit, or the paradigm has become too cumbersome and lost its explanatory power. So we might think here of Ptolemaic astronomy, where after 1,000 years, it had become so big and so cumbersome that there was really almost no explanatory power. The model was just gigantic. And there were still a wide number of anomalies that didn't fit, that nobody could make sense of in light of a system with the Earth in the middle. So the anomalies mount and eventually lead to crisis. And this is a period of professional insecurity in a field. Kuhn says a period of insecurity for the practitioners in a specific discipline. And the crisis period in science can last for several decades, even generations of scientists. And again, thinking of Ptolemy, you know, it can be 400 or 500 years of just trouble. So first there's the emergence of a crisis. Second, then we have the response to the crisis. And there are really two parts to the response to the crisis. The first thing that scientists do is they dig in their heels. And I'll give a couple reasons for that. First of all, scientists are patient. There are always anomalies, and most are minor discrepancies that eventually yield to the understanding of science within the paradigm. So there are always facts that don't fit, always pieces of the puzzle that don't fit. As Kuhn says, persistent and recognized anomaly does not always induce crisis. And I think this is legitimate, considering the history of science, considering the number of problems that have been worked out without major crises, major transformations. Scientists can wait. Also, scientists can be patient, in other words, because they're rarely working on the big picture. Most often they're working on small pieces, little pieces. Also, scientists are focused. In Kuhn's words, there are always difficulties somewhere in the paradigm nature fit. Most of them are set right sooner or later, often by processes that could not have been foreseen. The scientist who pauses to examine every anomaly, he notes, will seldom get significant work done. So scientists are focused on very small pieces often, very little things, and there may be a large number of anomalies that have come up in other ways affecting the paradigm, but if it doesn't affect their little specific piece of research, it may not be cause really for much of their concern. I think a sort of final response or a final reason why scientists dig their heels in is because they're so good at ad hoc solutions or manipulations, additions to a theory or minor remedies to get a theory or a paradigm going again. Kuhn says, though they may begin to lose faith and then consider alternatives, they do not renounce the paradigm that has led them into crisis. The source of resistance is the assurance that the older paradigm will ultimately solve all its problems, that nature can be shoved into the box the paradigm provides. So, first scientists dig in their heels, and they wait. And I'm still here under paradigm shifts in reality. I'm going to be there for a while. Eventually, however, they do face the crisis. And this is the period Kuhn calls extraordinary science. In other words, this is a period of a wide diversity of research, promulgation of theories, a lot of activity, a lot of innovation, a lot of imaginative work. This period as well can last for several generations, just the sort of facing of the crisis. What happens, and I'll just sort of run through this and then I'll come back and say it again, is that the paradigm becomes blurred, allowing for an increased breadth in research. There's a change in standards for both acceptable problems and acceptable solutions. And there's a questioning of the legitimate problems and solutions themselves. There's also what's called non-paradigm driven or random research. increase in diversity of research, this increase in diversity of research leads to a proliferation of theories. New facts or anomalies present themselves, or anomalies are connected and combined in new ways. Speculative theories emerge that, if proven, will lead to a new paradigm. So this is all going on inside the lab. The paradigm has become blurred. In other words, the paradigm has, nobody really knows anymore what it means, what it covers, what it understands. Standards go out the window. All kinds of new and innovative research takes place that would have never taken place under a paradigm. The anomalies that were perceived perhaps earlier, they begin to be the source of significant research themselves. Often anomalies are connected in new ways. New facts, as I said, appear. New anomalies come up that all of a sudden have bearing where they didn't before. And so all of this new activity, and again, this is what Kuhn calls extraordinary science, goes on. This is, I think, in part, I don't know if you've read any of these articles in Time magazine or something, where researchers spend 70 and 80 hours a week in the lab, you know, sleeping there, eating there, just going, working, because they're hot on the trail of something. This is sort of the picture of extraordinary science. You know, researchers just going crazy. Now, as I said, this is going on inside the lab. There's also something, as they're facing the crisis, that's going on outside the lab. And that's the search for and critical examination of assumptions. It's a questioning not only of the paradigm, but what has led them into the paradigm. What has led them to view the world in the way they have. In other words, what are the assumptions? What are the presuppositions that have led them into this particular way of framing, of forming the problem, of giving structure to the problem? And this, as I said, is going on outside the lab. And this is often sort of the debate in the scientific journals that's going on. And then there's the debate that's focused on the equations, that's focused on the experiments, focused on the problems. So there's sort of two debates going on, both on these levels. Now, eventually, through this process of extraordinary science, alternative paradigms arise. So there are at least two paradigms, the old one and a new one. Often there's the old one and two, three more. And we move into sort of the third stage here under the paradigm shifts in reality, which is the comparison process. Scientists are no longer testing facts, but rather testing entire paradigms. And again, this assumes that there's another paradigm out there. They're comparing paradigms. Kuhn says, once it has achieved the status of a paradigm, a scientific theory is declared invalid only if an alternative candidate is available to take its place. The act of judgment that leads scientists to reject a previously accepted theory is always based upon more than a comparison of that theory with the world. The decision to accept another and the judgment leading to that decision involve the comparison of both paradigms with nature and with each other. So as I said, there's a comparison going on here and a testing going on, not of data in the world, but with one paradigm with another. And the scientists are questioning which fits the facts better, which one makes sense of the world better. And this is not easy. Often scientists are in different worlds as they go through this. In other words, scientists holding different paradigms, because the paradigms are incommensurable, are often themselves in different worlds, are often in incommensurable worlds. Kuhn says the proponents of competing paradigms are always at least slightly at cross purposes. Neither side will grant all the non-empirical assumptions that the other needs in order to make its case. They are bound partly to talk through each other. Though each may hope to convert the other to his way of seeing his science and its problems, neither may hope to prove his case. The competition between paradigms is not the sort of battle that can be resolved by proofs. So this communication is across a revolutionary divide, and it's partial, it's fragmented. There's very little real communication going on, a lot of talking past each other. It's as if, Kuhn says, as if they practice their trades in different worlds. And so there's disagreement at this level about what the specific problems are that the paradigm must resolve, and there's disagreement about what a solution would be that would resolve the problems. Also, there's a lot of misunderstanding as to how to apply the vocabulary and apparatus, the experimental apparatus, from a previous paradigm. So, all three of these sections then, the emergence of crisis, the response to the crisis, and the comparison process has led us up to the revolution. Finally, there is some sort of revolution, some sort of paradigm shift takes place. The paradigm shift that takes this is the paradigm shift that takes a discipline into a whole new world. Kuhn describes the revolution as those non-cumulative developmental episodes in which an older paradigm is replaced in whole or in part by an incompatible new one. Now, he uses the term non-cumulative there. Again, he's very much, and I haven't brought it out that much, but he's very much obliterating this whole myth of science as sort of accumulation of knowledge advancing very orderly and reasonably through the centuries. And he lays it out as very much a battleground between these competing paradigms, competing scientists. So I want to bring some of that out. Kuhn is consciously playing on the political revolution metaphor here. In other words, or the idea being that one government has ceased to adequately meet the needs of the people and is toppled. Its malfunction has led to a revolution. So he's saying that metaphor applies for science. Another metaphor he uses would be of the Gestalt switch. I hope everybody is familiar with that term. He says, like the Gestalt switch, scientists speak of the scales falling from the eyes or of the lightning flash that inundates a previously obscure puzzle, enabling its components to be seen in a new way that for the first time permits its solution. So, I think a question that we need to ask at this point and sort of in the midst of the revolution is, who is it that brings about these revolutions? Kuhn says there are sort of two things true about researchers who in part bring about revolutions. First of all, it takes researchers who are focused on the problems, on the anomalies, on the pieces that don't fit, the pieces of the puzzle that are somehow outside of the original paradigm. Also, it takes researchers who are young or new to the field. Kuhn says, invariably, their attention has been intensely concentrated upon the crisis-provoking problems. Usually, in addition, they are men so young or so new to the crisis-ridden field that practice has committed them less deeply than most of their contemporaries to the worldview and rules determined by the old paradigm. Almost always, the men who achieve these fundamental inventions of a new paradigm have been either very young or very new to the field whose paradigm they change. He says that a little later on. So, it takes someone who can overcome what I've labeled paradigm blindness to even at times see the anomalies, to even at times see the problems. And this term paradigm blindness you won't find in Kuhn. That's another sort of one of my constructs there. But Kuhn shares a fascinating example, and I want to share it with you, of this sort of idea of paradigm blindness and how we can get stuck in something so thoroughly that it's almost impossible to move out of it. This is it's a couple pages, but I think it's well worth reading, and I think it's just fascinating. Again, it's Kuhn sharing the example of the difficulty in changing the way we see things, the difficulty in changing paradigms, the difficulty in making this revolution. It's a psychological experiment here that he's sort of describing. In a psychological experiment that deserves to be far better known outside the trade, Brunner and Postman asked experimental subjects to identify on short and controlled exposures a series of playing cards. Many of the cards were normal, but some were made anomalous. For example, a red 6 of spades, or a black 4 of hearts. Each experimental run was constituted by the display of a single card to a single subject in a series of gradually increased exposures. After each exposure, the subject was asked what he had seen, and the run was terminated by 2 successive correct identifications. So they were flashing these cards somehow to the subjects. By exposures, I've taken to mean just sort of flashing them in some way. And they started out with very short exposure time, so it was just a very quick glimpse you got. And after a couple of successful identifications, correct identifications, then they'd move it up to, I think, a little bit, they'd give you a little longer to look at the cards. And proceed that way. And here's what Kuhn says they found. Even on the shortest exposures, many subjects identified most of the cards, and after a small increase, all the subjects identified them all. For the normal cards, these identifications were usually correct, but the anomalous cards were almost always identified, without apparent hesitation or puzzlement, as normal. The black four of hearts might, for example, be identified as the four of either spades or hearts. Without any awareness of trouble, it was immediately fitted to one of the conceptual categories prepared by prior experience. One would not even like to say that the subjects had seen something different from what they identified. With a further increase of exposure to the anomalous cards, subjects did begin to hesitate and to display awareness of anomaly. Exposed, for example, to the red six of spades, some would say, "That's the six of spades, but there's something wrong with it. The black has a red border." Further increase of exposure resulted in still more hesitation and confusion, until finally, and sometimes quite suddenly, most subjects would produce the correct identification without hesitation. Moreover, after doing this with two or three of the anomalous cards, they would have little further difficulty with the others. A few subjects, however, were never able to make the requisite adjustment of their categories. Even at 40 times the average exposure required to recognize normal cards for what they were, more than 10% of the anomalous cards were not correctly identified. And the subjects who then failed often experienced acute personal distress. One of them exclaimed, "I can't make the suit out, whatever it is. It didn't even look like a card that time. I don't know what color it is now, or whether it's a spade or a heart. I'm not even sure what a spade looks like. My God!" Kuhn concludes, "Either as a metaphor or because it reflects the nature of the mind, that psychological experiment provides a wonderfully simple and cogent schema for the process of scientific discovery. In science, as in the playing card experiment, novelty emerges only with difficulty, manifested by resistance, against a background provided by expectation." So, that was a bit lengthy, but I thought that was just wonderful in describing how difficult it can be to see something in a new way. All right, let's go on. I'm still under the paradigm shifts in reality, and I've got one last section here. I want to talk about just some of the elements that make up one of these revolutions, some of the elements that are present. What brings about the shift? What is it that overcomes this resistance? Well, first of all, it's a conversion experience, says Kuhn, and I want you to note the language there. That was one of, way back when I first read this book, that was one of the things that caught my mind. He says it's a conversion experience, and there are basically two parts to it. And this is another one of my divisions to simplify things, not his. Again, it's being the reasons, what are some of the reasons why we make these paradigm shifts? And I've divided it up basically into objective and subjective, being my two parts. And really the objective, the main reason is that the new paradigm solves the problems that led to the crisis. And this is usually the most effective reason for a shift, says Kuhn, and that's understandable. The new paradigm has quantitative precision and superiority. Its argument or problem-solving ability alone are what, for most scientists, are the reason or the main reason why they would make that shift. However, this is not always enough, says Kuhn, and he goes on to talk about several subjective reasons, and I'm just going to sort of list a few, and I'm going to give you some quotes from him, not say that much about them. I'll say more about them in the next section, though. But these are some subjective reasons, and these are entirely outside of science, he says. They're rarely made explicit, and they're certainly almost never found in the history of science books or the science textbooks that we might see. These are issues of personal biography, nationalism, ethnicity, reputation, politics, even religion. An example Kuhn cites is that sun worship helped make Kepler a Copernican. Kepler was one of the main proponents of Copernicanism not too long after Copernicus. And that was, of course, sounds very odd, but that's something that Kuhn cites. Let me throw out four more, just sort of subjective reasons, kind of quickly here. One is that the new theory is aesthetically superior. Kuhn says, these are the arguments, rarely made explicit, that appeal to the individual sense of the appropriate or the aesthetic. The new theory is said to be neater, more suitable or simpler than the old. There's also a community aspect. This would be another sort of subjective reason why scientists make this shift. But if a paradigm is ever to triumph, it must gain some first supporters. Men who will develop it to the point where hard-headed arguments can be produced and multiplied. And even those arguments, when they come, are not individually decisive. Because scientists are reasonable men, one or another argument will ultimately persuade many of them. But there is no single argument that can or should persuade them all. Rather than a single group conversion, and there's that word again, what occurs is an increasing shift in the distribution of professional allegiances. So there's a community aspect there, and it involves a sense of conversion that a community makes. There's also what Kuhn calls the attraction to a new community or to the new community. If they are competent, they will improve the new paradigm, explore its possibilities, and show what it would be like to belong to the community guided by it. And as that goes on, if the paradigm is one destined to win its fight, the number and strength of the persuasive arguments in its favor will increase. And then a sort of last or fourth element under the sort of subjective reasons of why scientists change their mind would be the element of faith. And Kuhn uses that word, and let me quote from him. The man who embraces a new paradigm at an early stage must often do so in defiance of the evidence provided by problem solving. He must, that is, have faith that the new paradigm will succeed with the many large problems that confront it, knowing only that the older paradigm has failed with a few. A decision of that kind can only be made on faith. So, I think those are very provocative. So Kuhn has likened this whole revolution, this whole paradigm shift, to a political revolution or to a gestalt shift. And then we've gone on to fill it out the picture some more of what exactly it is. And the last sort of metaphor he uses, or that I want to bring out from him, is this one of religious conversion. That it's a step of faith. It's a conversion experience. Combining both the objective and the subjective, it's a conversion that happens. A couple more quotes from Kuhn. The transfer of allegiance from paradigm to paradigm is a conversion experience that cannot be forced. Still, to say that resistance is inevitable and legitimate, that paradigm change cannot be justified by proof, is not to say that no arguments are relevant, or that scientists cannot be persuaded to change their minds. Though a generation is sometimes required to effect the change, scientific communities have again and again been converted to new paradigms. Furthermore, these conversions occur not despite the fact that scientists are human, but because they are. Though some scientists, particularly the older and more experienced ones, may resist indefinitely, most of them can be reached in one way or another. Conversions will occur a few at a time until, after the last holdouts have died, the whole profession will again be practicing under a single, but now different paradigm. So again, I think we have to note the religious language there, and I'm going to bring that out a bit in the next section, but I want you to note that it's a conversion experience that's going on. So let me summarize this section, and this will be the end of the book review as well of Kuhn. I hope I've sparked your interest a bit. It's a very readable book, and it's not too incredibly long. So, let me summarize this section. Paradigm shifts are necessitated by crises that demonstrate that a specific paradigm is no longer able to explain or resolve a particular problem. A paradigm shift is a radical revolution or reorientation of one's perspective and way of seeing the world. It can best be likened to a conversion experience. Okay. Let's move on and take the concept of paradigm shifts, or a paradigm shift, into apologetics. And as I say there in part A, I think that the task for contemporary apologetics is focusing in on or learning about paradigm shifts, becoming astute to paradigm shifts. And as I said in the sort of intro, what I'm hoping to do now is to to introduce this term into the vocabulary, into the lexicon of apologetics. I think it's a very fruitful idea, and I think it can be very helpful. Let me first say a few things about why paradigms, and then we'll talk a bit about what we've learned from Kuhn. I'll turn this off. Why paradigms? In other words, why should we approach apologetics at the level of paradigms? I think first because very few people anymore have a developed or thought out worldview. And in the past, and I think it's still fruitful in some ways to talk about apologetics in terms of worldviews, that what we're trying to do is not only offer defense and a reason for our worldview, a reason for the way we see the world, but also to attack other people's worldview and to try and show them the anomalies or the inconsistencies there. But I think today that there are very few people who really think in terms of a worldview, who have that sort of broad, umbrella, all-encompassing view of the world, something that would be very systematic, very orderly, that would explain the world. I think more, that what's more true is that people think in terms of paradigms. They think in terms of life presenting them with a series of small puzzles. And certainly these two are connected. If you don't think in terms of worldviews, you must think in terms of paradigms. Or if you don't think in terms of paradigms, maybe it's in terms of theories. You know, but I think paradigms is a better way of putting it. Worldviews is too big, theories is too small. I think paradigms really summarizes where people are coming from. As I said, they approach life in terms of puzzles. They're no longer seeking or needing a unified theory. And as a result, people are comfortable or more comfortable today with inconsistencies. They're comfortable with answers that may be incompatible with each other, but that answer specific problems. Now, let me try and spell this out a bit. I've got some examples here of various paradigms that I think people actually hold that are entirely incommensurable with each other, but that people still hold. So let me throw out a few examples. For example, first would be a question, how did I get here? That would be a problem in front of people, and I think people might respond by, the answer would be by a purely chance process operating over millions of years under the mechanism of natural selection. So that would be a paradigm. I've got a problem, and I've got a way of solving that problem. I've got a way of understanding that. Another question the same person might be confronted with would be, how should I treat my fellow human beings? And the answer there might be with respect and kindness, because all human beings have innate or inherent value and dignity and should be treated as such. And again, that's a paradigm. That's a model for understanding that problem. Now, what I think is true today is that there are a lot of people who hold both of those, even though they're entirely incompatible. First one argues that evolution is how we got here. It's a purely chance process. There's no reason behind it, nothing special about it. We're just a product of chance. The second one argues that, well, we should still treat people with respect and kindness because they have innate dignity. Now, let me go on. Let me share another one. Similar thing here where I want to just give you some paradigms that I think people really think in. A question would be, or a problem that faces people would be, how do I explain evil or bad things in the world? And I think some answers would be, or some people might say, some people, due to genetic and environmental factors, act out their pain on society. They are not ultimately responsible for their actions. That would be a model for explaining why there are bad things in the world. Another question that same person who holds that paradigm might come across is, what does it mean to be a good citizen? And an answer might be, to obey the laws of our government, to vote, to oppose injustice, to be civic-minded, to cherish our freedom. In short, to be responsible. And I think that the same person could hold both those paradigms. I don't think I'm creating a caricature here or setting up anything. I think the same person could hold both those. One that argues that we should be responsible, and another that argues that, well, ultimately people aren't responsible. Let me look at one last one of these, and I hope I'm making my case here. A final sort of example question might be, what is the goal or purpose of life? And I think somebody might answer, to make it to the top, to be the best, to achieve riches, fame, and power. That's the goal. A second question that same person might be confronted with is, who is one of your heroes in life and why? I think someone might answer, Mother Teresa, because she is so giving and selfless. And again, I don't think I'm creating a caricature to say that there are people who hold both of those paradigms, with absolutely no sense of the tension of the inconsistency there. So these are some illustrations that I want to throw out to show that life is composed of small problems to be solved or questions to be answered, and to show that people, I think, today are more comfortable than ever with inconsistencies, that their answers may be incommensurable with each other. Ultimately, what I'm arguing here in this first part is just that paradigms do justice to the way people approach life. They do justice to the way that people think about life and the way that people act in life. So that's why I think this whole idea of paradigms is important. Let me move on then to just what we've learned from Kuhn. And I'm still under there, the sort of task for contemporary apologetics. Let me bring out what I think we've learned from Kuhn that's applicable in terms of our apologetics. How would our apologetics take into account the need for paradigm shifts, in other words? First of all, there would be the necessity of a crisis. This is probably the main thing that we've learned from Kuhn, is that we somehow have to create a crisis. Anomalies must be manifested. And these anomalies, they must be made so big that they create a crisis. And again, this is more than just demonstrating inconsistencies. I think this is showing people that there are fundamental problems with the way that they're thinking. Now, I think also, as we do this, we have to remember that we'll encounter resistance. And I think we have to remember that it's difficult, that this is difficult to change paradigms. And again, we can remember the playing card experience here. That it's difficult to make that kind of shift. Also, as we're doing this, as we're trying to precipitate these crises, I think another thing will be that there'll be attempts will be made to alter the existing paradigm. And as we said earlier, that often this is a time of great insecurity, professional insecurity in the scientific field, and I think we should expect that in terms of people as well, that if we're stirring these kinds of things up, if we're stirring up crisis, that there'll be insecurity. Eventually, hopefully, the crises will be faced. The crisis that we create will be faced, but we should be prepared for a period of real insecurity. Then, as we provoke these crises, the questioning of fundamental assumptions must begin. And again, this is something I think I want to bring right out of Kuhn, right into our approach in terms of apologetics. New explanations have to be explored, and again, this is not only a questioning of the data, but of the way we see the data, the way we frame the data itself. You know, a real questioning at the level, as he says, of fundamental assumptions, fundamental presuppositions. The second thing I think we can bring from Kuhn, and I've just got, what do I have, just five things here. So if you're jotting notes, you can jot through. The second major thing I think we need to bring from Kuhn is the idea that we have to present a plausible option. We have to give people another paradigm to shift into. A plausible option must be presented for conversion to. And there's a need here for hard-headed arguments to convince people of a new and different paradigm. And as this comparison process begins, as we present people with another option, we also as well have to maintain that incommensurability. We have to make sure people realize they're looking at two different worlds. And I think as well, again, we should remember the staying power of the old paradigm has to be recognized. And at this point, a way maybe we would say this would be that we have to prevent syncretism. Can't allow for both an adoption of the new paradigm and a bringing in of some of the assumptions of the old paradigm, a sneaking in some of the things that would be, in a sense, incommensurable. A third thing I think that I want to bring from Kuhn into the task of apologetics, is just that there will be communication difficulties. And I think we should acknowledge this, that it's really as if we're speaking two different languages. We are in two different worlds with people, and it's as if we're speaking two different languages, often at times crossing each other, not hearing each other. A fourth thing would just be the element of faith that Kuhn talks about, and again, we have to remember that ultimately it is a conversion experience that we're after, and Kuhn as well likens science to that, that scientists undergo a conversion experience, and I think that's very important for us, and that there's an element of faith here. It's a conversion involving faith. And then fifthly, or the last thing, let me just throw out a couple things here, a couple more thoughts. That finally there comes a revolution. And often this takes a young person or someone who's newly involved. That we must show a qualitative and quantitative superiority to get this revolution to come about. That we must demonstrate a better degree of problem solving. That often this involves a community aspect. And that getting somebody to the point of that revolution, there's got to be a community as well there, both to bring them into, I think, and to demonstrate things for them. And lastly, that there are these objective and subjective reasons that people make paradigm shifts, that there are both, that it's not just all an intellectual process. So these are some thoughts. These thoughts are strictly from Kuhn, and I think the Bible would give us many more about how to get people to make paradigm shifts, how to get people to change their minds, to undergo these revolutions. Things like the need for prayer, the role of the Holy Spirit, etc. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff that we could mine out of the Bible. And what I'm doing here is I'm just bringing some things from Kuhn, and I don't want to force an alien philosophical system on the Bible or something. In other words, I'm not saying that I've found the key for understanding New Testament apologetics, and only if you have my word term paradigm can you understand it. What I'm saying is I think this is a very helpful term, and I think it's a term that we need to use more often, that we need to really become aware of and able to use. So let's go on now and look at some biblical examples then of what I call the paradigm shift approach, and that would be sort of the final section. And I'm going to go through quite a number, I guess, of examples. And what I want to do here is really connect all this theoretical stuff with a bit of practical stuff, although I think I'm still in the theoretical realm. Let me just make one note about Christian paradigms and the Christian worldview in general. If a worldview is made up of paradigms, as I've argued earlier, then likewise the Christian worldview will be made up of certain paradigms. And I think that it is. Again, I'm not trying to force something on the Bible. I think that at least the Christian worldview is made up of the paradigms of creation, fall, and redemption. Those would be the sort of at least the three biggies. But there's also a paradigm for the nature of God, for salvation, theodicy, prayer, sanctification, authority of Scripture, the church, all these things. We could picture having a model for each of these, and that to be a Christian, to have a sort of a functional Christian worldview, we've got to have a model for each of these elements, and it's got to be a thoroughly biblical and thoroughly Christian one. A question, though, that comes up, I think, anytime you start dividing things up like this, is the question would be, is one more important than the other? In other words, is there a hierarchy, or are these just pieces of a puzzle? Well, I think for the most part they're just pieces of a puzzle, but I think there is one that I would call the gateway paradigm. There's one Christian paradigm that makes up, again, the Christian worldview that I think is more important than the others, and that most fundamental paradigm would be one of non-self-righteousness or humility before God. In other words, this is the sort of gateway. You can't be a Christian unless you go through this paradigm shift. Unless you make this shift, you're not in. And we can debate which other ones are absolutely necessary and which other ones are secondary or tertiary or things like that. But at least I think you have to grant that this one is absolutely necessary. The ultimate shift we want people to make is from one of self-righteousness to trusting only in God's ability to make us righteous. One of self-justification to trusting only in God's ability to justify us. So how do we induce this shift and others as well? Let's look into that. And again, I'm not trying to go to the text in some sort of eisegetic fashion where I bring something in that's going to unlock the New Testament for us or something. I just want to bring to the text what we've learned, I think, from Kuhn in the nature of scientific revolutions. I want to bring that to the task of apologetics and look at a few biblical examples. Okay, the first one, and I've got, I don't know how many, I've got three or four here. The first one is from Jesus' remark in Mark 2:22, where Jesus says, "And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is lost, and the skins as well. But one puts new wine into fresh wineskins." Now, this comment of Jesus is found in all three of the Synoptic Gospels. And the idea, of course, behind it is that new wine, as it ferments, gives off gas. And if you put it in the old skins, they're rigid, and they're unable to expand with the wine, and they'll burst. They'll break. So in the language of paradigms, I think what Jesus is saying is, don't try to put my message through the old paradigm. Don't try and understand me and what I'm about through an old paradigm. I think this is sort of the clearest statement about the need for paradigm shifts in the New Testament. I would offer it as sort of the guiding metaphor or the central New Testament image for the paradigm shift approach, if you need a verse or something. Now let's look at a couple more in depth. I want to start in John 4 with Jesus with the woman at the well. And let me just say a couple things about her paradigm, about her worldview, and then I'll read through this, and then I'll try and reflect a bit on it in terms of what we've learned. She has obviously a Samaritan paradigm. She's the woman at the well is a Samaritan, and the major element I think of the Samaritan paradigm is the place of worship, that they worship at the mountain or on the mountain, and the mountain is Gerizim. Thank you, I forgot that. They worship on the mountain. And that would be sort of the central element of her paradigm. She assumes, of course, that Jesus has a Jewish paradigm. He's a Jewish man. She assumes that Jesus is thinking that the place of worship is in Jerusalem at the temple. And so that's the paradigm she has and that she's assuming Jesus has. Also, a bit of background that we have to know to really see the sense of the paradigms here is that the Samaritans wanted to worship the Lord with the Jews in Jerusalem at the temple, but they were excluded for a variety of sort of historical reasons I won't go into. But they were excluded, and as the text tells us, the Jews didn't have anything to do with the Samaritans. The Jews wouldn't have any relations whatsoever with the Samaritans. So, with that in mind, let's take a look at this dialogue and let's see what we can come up with here. I'm in John 4, and I'll start in verse 7. "There came a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus said to her, 'Give me a drink.' For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman therefore said to him, 'How is it that you, being a Jew, ask me for a drink, since I am a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans.' Jesus answered and said to her, 'If you knew the gift of God, and who it is who says to you, "Give me a drink," you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water.' She said to him, 'Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water? You are not greater than our father Jacob, are you, who gave us the well and drank of it himself and his sons and his cattle?' Jesus answered and said to her, 'Everyone who drinks of this water shall thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall become in him a well of water springing up to eternal life.' The woman said to him, 'Sir, give me this water, so I will not be thirsty, nor come all the way here to draw.' He said to her, 'Go, call your husband and come here.' The woman answered and said, 'I have no husband.' Jesus said to her, You have well said, I have no husband. For you have had five husbands, and the one whom you have now is not your husband. This you have said truly.' The woman said to him, 'Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet.'" Now I'm going to pause there for a minute. As we look at this, and keep in mind the idea of paradigms, I think at first we see a bit of Jesus is kind of talking past her. She's in a completely different world. He's talking about living water. She's trying to figure out how to get water out of the well. He's talking about water, a source of water never run dry. She wants this, but she's not quite following. She realizes that there's something more going on here, I think. But there's a bit of this missing in terms of communication. Where I stop there then, in terms of the woman saying, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet," some commentators make the comment that this is just sort of a dodge on her part. She's trying to sort of, he's brought up something from her past, something from her life currently that is demonstrates that she's an immoral woman, and she wants to try and get out of it. I don't think that's the case at all, and I'm indebted to my wife here in part, who's done a lot more study in John. She helped me to sort of see this, that her question makes sense, and she's going to follow up this with a question, if Jesus is a prophet. Because remember, as I said, the central paradigm for her is that worship is on the mountain. The central paradigm she assumes for Jesus is that worship is in the temple. And her question here, which is, in verse 20, "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you people say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship." She wants to know, where should she worship? Where is the right place? This is the sort of central question. She wants to know if it's okay to worship on the mountain. She wants an answer to the central question Samaritans faced. Now Jesus is going to go on here to tell her it's not on the mountain or in Jerusalem. It's neither of those places. He's going to, in a sense, drop one of these crises right into her paradigm. Say, it's not that at all. It's a whole new way of approaching God. Listen to what he says. "Woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem shall you worship the Father. But an hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and truth. For such people the Father seeks to be his worshipers. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." So it's a whole new way of approaching God that Jesus lays out. And he sort of drops this crisis right in there that it's not about worshiping at a mountain or worshiping in Jerusalem or where you worship. It's in spirit and in truth. It's something entirely different. Now, if you read on in the text, she seems to have believed, which brings many other Samaritans to Jesus, and Jesus ends up staying there a couple of days. I think, and this is purely conjectural, but I wonder if part of the reason why she believed so quickly was that perhaps because she was not a part of either paradigm, she had no investment in either paradigm, she could make the shift easier. In other words, and this is more of a sort of homiletic note, I think Jesus' comment to her would have been the best news ever. And we talk about the gospel in terms of good news, and I think this was good news. She was one, due to her social stigma, and she was obviously an immoral woman, probably a prostitute. She'd come to the well at noon when no one else was going to be there because she didn't want to be there when the other women were there. She was an outcast in that respect. She was not a part of the regular Samaritan life. Because of that social stigma, she was probably excluded not only from Jewish worship, which she was as a Samaritan, but the Samaritan worship as well. She had no place of worship, no way to worship God. And I think what Jesus said to her was probably just, it was a completely different paradigm, but I think she probably grabbed onto that, as tight as anyone, as tight and as quickly as anyone would come to the gospel, because it was such a new thing. And for her, such good news, such amazing news. So, I hope you've seen there a bit now of what I've been talking about in terms of paradigms. Let's go on and look at another example, also in John, and I think this one is equally helpful in terms of showing an awareness on Jesus' part of the whole idea of paradigms, that people think in terms of paradigms, that we have to approach people in terms of necessitating crises in their paradigm. I want to look at, Jesus with Nicodemus in John chapter 3. Let me mention a few of Nicodemus' assumptions, part of his paradigm. First we have to, first the text says that he's a Pharisee and a leader of the Jews. Pharisee meaning a separated one, and he was part of a distinct religious elite within the Jewish culture. Also, being a leader of the Jews meant he was a part of the Sanhedrin. the fundamental assumption here that he has is that the reason he was a member of the people of God was that he was born of a Jewish father and circumcised. So primarily his birth, it was primarily his birth that made him a member of the people of God. And he had implicit faith in his Jewish nationality, heritage, ancestry, as well as obedience to law, implicit faith that if he did those, had his Jewish heritage and was obedient to the law, that would ensure his righteousness. He was righteous with those things. Let's listen to what Jesus, keeping that in mind, that's his paradigm, that's what's going through his head. Listen to what Jesus says to him. Says that Nicodemus came at night, says to Jesus, "Rabbi, we know that you have come from God as a teacher, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him." Jesus answered and said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God." Nicodemus said to him, "How can a man be born when he is old? He cannot enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born, can he?" Jesus answered, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born of water and the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. Do not marvel that I said to you, you must be born again." So, in the language of paradigm, and what we've been talking about, Jesus has just dropped a crisis right in there. Because Nicodemus' whole background is that I'm righteous. I've got the ancestry, I've got the pedigree for it, and I've got the works. I'm a Pharisee, I'm a part of the Sanhedrin, I'm set. And Jesus says, your background, your upbringing means nothing. The literal translation of that, you must be born again, the idea of being born again, is to be re-begotten from above. So in Jesus' paradigm, Nicodemus' Jewish birth means nothing. He's got to be reborn from above. Now surely Nicodemus thought, I don't need this. I don't need to be reborn again. I've got my Jewish background. But I think Jesus just, he goes right for the fundamental assumptions. And you can see in the dialogue, Nicodemus comes in, he sort of plays up to him, and Jesus cuts right to the quick. He doesn't respond with, "You're right, I'm a good teacher, oh how nice to see you," any of that. Right to the point. He says, "You want to have eternal life? You got to be born again." And I think he's questioning Nicodemus' implicit trust here in his Jewish heritage. He's telling him he must be born again. Not that it's an option, or not that this would be a good thing, or not that, well, like John baptized in the wilderness, you should be baptized, but that he must be born again. Now, a little later on, Jesus not only questions his Jewish birth, but he questions his teacher, his status as teacher of Israel. And that's in verse 10. He says, "Are you the teacher of Israel and do not understand these things?" So again, he's hitting him, dropping these crises in there. Are you the teacher of Israel and you don't understand? And you can see Nicodemus, first it's his indignation, but also his sense of, wait a minute, you know, what's going on here? Lastly, in terms of this dialogue here, Jesus points Nicodemus to an anomaly, I think, that he should reconsider. And he points him to a piece of data that he wants him to reevaluate. Let me read the verses here, verses 14 and 15. And Jesus is speaking to Nicodemus. He says, "And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes may in him have eternal life." So now let me give you a little background to this, because likewise there's a whole paradigm here, and Jesus is trying to say to Nicodemus, you know, here's a way to get out of your paradigm. Here's a piece from your background, certainly a piece, because Nicodemus is going to know the Old Testament. Here's a piece from your background that if you'll look at it in a new way, here's an anomaly, if you'll look at again, consider again, you'll see it in a new way. Let me read you the part from Numbers that Jesus is referring to so that we can catch the idea too. Israel, this is in Numbers, God has taken them out of Egypt, all these miracles, they're now in the desert, wandering around, he's done all these great things. Then they set out from Mount Hor by way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey. And the people spoke against God and Moses, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people so that many people of Israel died. So the people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord and you. Intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us." And Moses interceded for the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Make a fiery serpent and set it on a standard, and it shall come about that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, he shall live." And Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on the standard, and it came about that if a serpent bit any man, when he looked at the bronze serpent, he lived. Now, the serpent, of course, in this story, represents the consequences of the people's sin. They grumbled against God and against Moses. And they ask Moses, pray to God, intercede for us to have the serpents taken away. God doesn't take away the serpents. Rather, he instead gives them a way to be saved. He doesn't take away the consequences of their sin. He gives them a way to be saved in light of their sin. And I think Jesus is saying that God has provided for Nicodemus in the same way. He's saying, look again at this piece of information. Think about it. This piece of information is a key to a whole new paradigm, a whole new way of understanding. So, that's it for John 3, but I think it's interesting. Nicodemus shows up later in the Gospel of John, at least two times. The first is in John 7, and I think this is very interesting. I think Nicodemus caught a bit of what Jesus was saying. I think that the seeds of revolution were sown there, and he began to think a bit differently. Let me read this to you, how Nicodemus comes up later. "The officers therefore came to the chief priests and Pharisees, and they said to them, 'Why did you,' the chief priests said, 'Why did you not bring him in?'" Meaning Jesus. They sent him to arrest Jesus. "The officers answered, 'Never did a man speak the way this man speaks.' The Pharisees therefore answered them, 'You have not also been led astray, have you? No one of the rulers or Pharisees has believed in him, has he? But this multitude which does not know the law is accursed.' Nicodemus said to them," he who came to him before being one of them, and he came to Jesus, "'Our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him and knows what he is doing, does it?' They answered and said to him, 'You are not also from Galilee, are you? Search and see that no prophet arises out of Galilee.'" Now, I think this is fascinating, because what they don't say to Nicodemus, they don't debate the law with him. They blast him for breach of paradigm. "You have stepped outside of the paradigm. The paradigm says that the Messiah isn't coming from Galilee. That's it. Period, paragraph." And I think Nicodemus has begun to think. I think he's realizing there's something more going on here. I've got to be willing to let go of some of my earlier assumptions and look at things in a new way. I've got to consider this guy Jesus in a new way. And I think they just blast him. You're not allowed outside of the paradigm. You're not allowed to think in a new way. The last place that Nicodemus shows up is with Joseph of Arimathea to get the body of Jesus and to bury him. So I think that Nicodemus was able to at least in some way see things differently. See things certainly differently than the rest of the Jews. Let me share one or two more. I'm getting all excited myself here. Let's look at the parable of the Good Samaritan. I think this one especially reveals the assumption here of self-righteousness. And I think he is great. Let's read this. Let me read a bit of this. This is Luke 10, 25-37, the parable of the Good Samaritan. And I think let me read it to you. "And behold, a certain lawyer stood up and put him to the test, saying, 'Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?' And he said to him, 'What is written in the law? How does it read to you?'" So Jesus is saying, "What's your paradigm? Play this out for me." And the lawyer says, and he answered and said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, Jesus, "You have answered correctly. do this and you will live. So he lays out his paradigm. Jesus gets him to lay out his paradigm there. First he states his paradigm. And then now watch what's going to happen here. But wishing to justify himself, he said to Jesus, and this is the thing, self-justification. He said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Jesus replied and said, "A certain man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers. And they stripped him and beat him, and went off leaving him half dead. And by chance a certain priest was going down on that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. And likewise a Levite also, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, who was on a journey, came upon him, and when he saw him, he felt compassion. And he came to him and bandaged up his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them. And he put him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And on the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper and said, 'Take care of him, and whatever more you spend when I return, I will repay you.' Which of these 3 do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell into the robber's hands?" And he said, and this is the lawyer, "The one who showed mercy toward him." And Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise." Now, I love this because what Jesus does is he drops this crisis in there in terms of redefining the term neighbor, but he gets the lawyer to say it. So it isn't Jesus saying, "Well, you know, here's what a neighbor is," but he gets the lawyer to say, "Gee, it was the one who showed him mercy. He was the neighbor." So he drops this bomb in there and exposes, he reaches to the root of his fundamental assumption by redefining neighbor and exposing his unrighteousness. Jesus exposes his lack of being able to justify himself, and he gets the lawyer to say it. That's the great part. He shows him a qualitatively superior paradigm, I think. See, he says, "You have a paradigm, which is that you love God and with all your heart, mind, and soul, and you love your neighbor as yourself. That's great. That's one way of becoming righteous. But here's a qualitatively better paradigm. Here's what it really says. Here's the way you really should approach it." And not only, so, and then he gets the lawyer to sort of, to fall in with him, to jump on board. But there's more here, because there's a hook here. There's a time bomb. And I'm indebted here to Dick Keyes to pointing some of this out. See, if he tries to live out this new definition of neighbor that he helped derive, he'll see that he can't. If he tries to be a good neighbor in this way, he'll realize it's impossible. We can't do it. Under every circumstance, we can't do it. And this will fundamentally obliterate his assumption that he can be righteous. In other words, there's a time bomb here that's just going to tick, tick, tick. And sure, maybe he'll be a good neighbor in the way he's defined for a week, a month, 6 months, but eventually he's going to fail. And it's going to come right up in his face that I'm not righteous. I've not lived up to it. Because he said it. He laid out the paradigm, and Jesus said, "You've answered correctly. Do this and you'll live." And then he says, "Well, the guy who showed mercy, that's what it means to be a good neighbor." So he's, in other words, he's brought the judgment on himself. It isn't that Jesus has even had to judge him. And this is what Jesus is so great in terms of, he gets the people to bring the judgment on themselves. He doesn't have to point the finger. So, I think that's another one of these cases where we can see Jesus with an awareness of the idea that there are different paradigms here, and that I've got to drop a crisis in there. I've got to initiate a crisis that's going to get people thinking. It's going to change the way they're thinking. I won't go through this in depth, but if you think about the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, Jesus is doing this again and again in terms of dropping these little crisis-provoking bombs into their worldview, and showing them the impossibility of self-righteousness. If you read through the Beatitudes, they're counter to our thinking. The meek shall inherit the earth. It doesn't add up. That's not what the facts show us. That's not what the evidence shows us. Jesus, what are you saying here? The evidence is that the Romans inherit the earth right now. The evidence is that the strong inherit the earth. And again, he's saying you've got to look at it a new way. Later in Matthew 5, verse 20, he says, "Unless your righteousness exceeds that of the Pharisees, you will not be saved. And that has got it. To them, that's righteousness, is the Pharisees. That's it. And just, again, he's just provoking these. They've got to be sort of doing a double take. What is he saying? How can this be? And he's just pulling on their paradigms, or pulling the pins out from under their paradigms. Let's just look at two last examples. One would be Peter and Jesus, because I think the disciples had to make a big paradigm shift here too. And I've borrowed this a bit from Oz Guinness. You know, he talks about this example in his. He has a series of tapes on apologetics. He probably mentions it other places. This is Matthew 16, and it's Peter's recognition of Jesus as Messiah. It's also recorded in Mark 8. Peter's going to get a huge compliment here, only to be moments later called Satan. And it seems like Peter has made the paradigm shift, the conversion, and yet moments later we see the staying power of the old paradigm. We see that he's trying in some way to fashion these two together. I can fit Jesus into the old thing somehow. And Jesus just blasts him. Let me read this. Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he began asking his disciples, saying, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, and others Elijah, but still others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter answered and said, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not overpower it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he warned the disciples that they should tell no one that he was the Christ. So Peter gets this huge compliment, and however you interpret that in terms of the Roman Catholic Church or whatever, at least in this instance, Peter's getting this huge compliment that he's going to be a pillar, at least, in the church. And then Jesus goes on. From that time Jesus Christ began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised up on the third day. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "God forbid it, Lord. This shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but man's." So Peter's just gotten his comment and just gotten blasted. But again, I think it's... And poor Peter, you know, he's got this paradigm. He sees something about Jesus. He knows that he's qualitatively different. And yet, and as the text says at points, the disciples didn't fully understand what was going on until after the resurrection. So he gets blasted here because he, in a sense, falls back into the old paradigm, where he's wavering between the two. So let me read one last passage, which is from Paul. And I think this is Paul's statement of his paradigm shift, or the way he shifted. And again, I'm not trying to bring something foreign to the text. I'm just trying to put a label, the term paradigm, on something that's already there. Where am I? Let's look in Philippians 3, verses 2 to 9. And Paul basically lists all the baggage that Nicodemus would have had in his conversation with Jesus. He lists all the baggage of a Jewish Pharisee, basically. Paul says, "For we are the true circumcision, who worship in the Spirit of God, and glory in Christ Jesus, and put no confidence in the flesh. Although I myself might have confidence even in the flesh, if anyone else has a mind to put confidence in the flesh, I far more, circumcised the eighth day, of the nation of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, as to the law a Pharisee, as to zeal a persecutor of the church, as to the righteousness which is in the law, found blameless. But whatever things were gained to me, those things I have counted as loss for the sake of Christ. More than that, I count all things to be loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and count them but rubbish, in order that I may gain Christ and may be found in him. And listen to the shift here. Not having a righteousness of my own derived from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness which comes from God on the basis of faith. So Paul has made that shift. He's moved from a paradigm of I'm righteous before God to one of I'm nothing. I'm absolutely, absolutely unself-righteous. I have nothing. Okay, let me summarize this whole thing and then we'll have some discussion. I have attempted to show that paradigm shifts or revolutions in science can serve as a model for how all people, not just scientists, come to see the world in a new way. Bearing this approach in mind, we can make contact with people at the level of their paradigms and hopefully initiate the crises that will lead to revolution, including and especially a shift to a paradigm of humility before God. Furthermore, I hope I have shown that this approach is biblical in its methodology while remaining fully contemporary in its application. So, I'll quit there. Thank you for your patience and for all of you hanging with me. I noticed a lot of people sticking right with me. Let's just open it up for questions. If you haven't been here before, what we do is just, we have a time of discussion and questions. If you need to go, feel free to go at any point. Anybody? Elliot?
Is the idea of a paradigm shift itself a paradigm
shift? Well, that's why I said it. And the part there, a paradigm, if you will. It is. You have to make a paradigm shift to understand paradigm shifts, I think.
Because the question is whether Kuhn is really, is he a scientist and philosopher, or is he a sociologist? And the story is describing what he sees, or has his theory added new knowledge. I thought that every time you use paradigm, I could think of a pretty good synonym for it. Preservation, presupposition, added assumption, continuity. That might have been this source of the earlier.
Yeah, I think you could come up with 22 different synonyms for how I've used the term tonight as well. It's a fluid term, and I don't want to get hung up on the term, although I think it's helpful, and that's why I tried to distinguish it from theories and from the notion of worldview. I think it's a helpful idea. We can get hung up. There's not only the term paradigm, but there's the term paradigmatic, which is the adjectival form of the word, if I've got that right, which can also throw you off. You often, people speak of paradigms when they mean paradigmatic. So.
But because you give something a name, it doesn't make it a thing.
No, and Kuhn as well says in his postscript, he's aware of the is-ought distinction. Just because you describe something doesn't mean you've now rendered how it ought to be. And he's also aware of the critique of the sort of, that he has relativized science, that he has made science a relative procedure by speaking of it in terms of paradigms and paradigm shifts. Because, of course, if you take him seriously, if you shift from one paradigm to another, you're seeing the world in a whole different way. Is it your way of seeing that's changed, or is it the world that's changed? And some have argued that it's the world that's changed, and that it's fundamentally a relative world, and that the world is constructed of how we describe it. And that if we don't describe it, it isn't there. So, for example, there was no such thing as, and this is where my science background falls short, there's no such thing as atoms and electrons and neutrons until we discover them and describe them. But that's an old debate in the philosophy of science in terms of, you know, that goes all the way back to the ancient mathematicians arguing, did we discover numbers or did they exist? Or did we create them? Sorry, did we discover them or did we create them? And it's the same debate.
Many of the examples paradigms in science, at least. I mean, I like to discuss scripture. But the scientific ones, a paradigm is a theory that proves to be important in retrospect. Could you say that? That basically...